Welcome to the Art Scene, presented each week by UALR Public Radio. I'm Anne Nicholson. This week is very special for me. My guest is Michael Fine, whose name is exceptional in music. He wins just about everything he touches. He is one of the first to be asked to record the works of others because his recordings are the ones that win prizes. His music wins awards. For him, the most of musical songs is that of the birds. For me, he is the finest and kindest of men. And I had lost touch with him, thanks to my own stupidity. So when I saw his name on the lineup for this season, I called him. So we talked a few days ago. His latest work, a concerto for oboe section, was commissioned by Philip Mann. A world premiere, and airs May 4th and 5th on Robinson Auditorium, Little Rock. And I see you're still having all the plaudits for the way that you've been able to. I used to say that it was Michael talking to the caves.
Oh, yes, indeed. Yes. Indeed. Listening to the birds.
Yes. And when you got into the caves talked. And you had to be very careful because they said things that might not be exactly giving the right honor, the right kind of balance, because caves and other things come on untoward in a way that can make it better.
Yeah.
And the caves themselves talk.
Nature definitely has a lot to say to us if we listen.
Yes.
I'm just happy the songbirds are finally back here in the Netherlands after a long winter, and we get to enjoy their company and their sounds for, well, let's hope for many months now.
Well, I was going to bring up the conversation we had, because you told me when your wife had been diagnosed, you were going on that wonderful pilgrimage in the north of Spain.
Yeah, we did that actually. She had already completed her first chemo, was in remission, and we hiked the last 115 kilometers of the Camino to Santiago. It was a wonderful trip. The mind is totally free. They say all you have to do basically is walk, walk, eat, and sleep.
Well, also the things that you brought up, and it has followed you all the way, and even more so for this new creation, is the fact that the birds were singing. You were absolutely enchanted by this, and they all seemed to be singing more than he or anybody had ever heard before. And you've kept those birds as a charm, perhaps, when you start creating new music.
Yeah, for sure. I've said it before, I think there's no more beautiful music than bird song, and I definitely miss the songbirds when they leave the northern parts of the world, but every now and then I'm lucky to go to another place they live, like Africa, during our winter months, and have their company. But the piece that Philip and the three oboists are going to play is a sort of bird song concerto as well. The oboes definitely have some affinity to the winged creatures, and there may be a little bit of that in this piece as well.
Well, you had written in it, according to the notes that have been given, that it's something you've wanted to do for a while, because for you, even more than a lot of people, the bird songs are so treasured. And to do that and put it into music so that you can bring it in anytime you want to must be something quite perilous, just in case something goes wrong.
To be honest, the initiation of this piece came from Philip Mann, who called me and said, how would I feel about writing a concerto for three oboes, one doubling on English horn? And I must say that after we stopped speaking, I began to write the piece. And it was commissioned by the Arkansas Symphony Orchestra. It will be played in what is sadly Philip's last concert as music director, but I'm very honored to be there to help him celebrate all he's achieved there, and that my piece will play a small part in that celebration. But the piece is, there's definitely birdsong. There's some pizzicato sections that are very much woodland oriented, but if we had to speak about it in a more musical way, it's a concerto grosso. So a conversation between three soloists and their string colleagues, handing themes back and forth, connecting interwoven sounds. And that's very much like when you listen to the birds in the trees, they are connecting to each other, sometimes connecting to us as well. But it's a piece I had great pleasure in writing, and I hope the musicians and the audience enjoy it as much as I do.
Well, you're pulling in, from what I can read on what's been written for you already, is the fact that so many of the birds in their human figures are giving you and giving us what we've learned over the years, that certain members of the birds, the birds and the people, have been able to join together in making a different sound, something that can only be made when people are different. And I wondered if that was something that you had expected or that you had hoped for.
I think when you learn to speak a language, when you learn to sing, when you hear things, first of all, there's conscious imitation. But then that imitation comes with your own voice, your own accent. And eventually your path diverges. You still keep much of what you remember, what you're imitating. But I think the first music had to have been that, someone imitating the sounds of nature and then diverging on their own path. I think it's true for all of us. All of our communication begins with that, the child listening to the parent, and then imitating those sounds. Or when we learn another language, imitating the sounds and then somehow diverging in our own direction. I mean, I would never say that my music is conscious imitation of bird songs, but it is very much connected to the natural world, how I perceive it. Now, you could listen to it and say, that doesn't sound at all like bird song or like nature. And that's perfectly all right, because at the same time, it's also absolute music. There's no conscious mimicking of a particular bird, like Delius in the first Cuckoo in Spring, or Respighi's The Birds, Gli Uccelli. It's the thing that inspires me a great deal, and not only birds, but the whole panoply of nature. I'm not terribly inspired by the urban environment, though I live in one. So in many ways, the writing of the music is taking me out of that environment into a more natural setting where I feel more at home, more connected. But I always tell people to play my music, and those who listen to it as well, please enjoy it in any way you like. And what I thought about when I was writing it is really irrelevant. And this piece came together, I must say, very, very quickly for me. It just came. It was a pleasure to write. I'd already heard the musicians, because I'd heard the orchestra previously, so I had an idea of who they are and how they play. And almost all of my concertos and solo pieces do have someone in mind, a certain sound, and these three wonderful musicians had sent me some recordings of their trio, so I had an idea of where their musical sensibilities were, where their aesthetic is, and I try to honor that as well.
Has it struck you that now they're all sounding a little different?
Oh, I won't know till I hear them. I'm very curious. It's interesting, and because they sent me an email asking questions about the piece, and of course, I wrote back. I said, I'm much more interested in what you have to say about my music than what I have to say. And As I told Philip Mann the first time I came to Little Rock and he conducted Suite for Strings, that he found more music in my music than I ever knew was there, even as the composer. The joy in writing music is seeing what happens when other people bring their own insights and aesthetic to the music.
Well, I was going to bring this up because that's the only piece I've heard you make that I've yet heard. And it was Philip who said that it was the first composing you'd ever done.
That's indeed correct.
I was in this audience at that time, so
I remember.
Now it's just part of it all. But what I also had to chuckle over when you mentioned just now, pizzicato. We get passionate about pizzicato. And pizzicato has to be in every piece of music that catches your heart. It has to have pizzicato.
Yeah, and all the composers, the great composers, and that doesn't include me, by the way, but the great composers all used it in different and unique ways as coloristic devices, as a rhythmic device. But it's definitely part of, especially when you're writing for strings, which is one of my favorite things to do. Now, of course, I had to send a piano reduction to the oboist so that they could practice the piece, and the piano can't play pizzicato, so in some ways I was concerned that they would get the wrong idea about the piece because the piano can't achieve those kinds of sounds. But I'm extremely curious, and to be very honest, composing music is a leap of faith because you really don't know exactly what's going to happen when the musicians get their hand on the music. Very often they make it better than you ever suspected, and I've often said that good musicians make mediocre composers look good. I still believe that. But I also appreciate the fact this is the third piece that Philip and the Arkansas Symphony will play of my music so that they have an idea of my aesthetic and what I'm trying to say and that they share it with me. They were so very kind last year after the premiere of the Concerto for Two Violins that Kirill and Drew played. So I think they have an idea about what to expect. There's nothing radically different in this piece, though it maybe goes in a slightly different direction in a few places. There may be a few surprises.
Was it one or two or more surprises that surprised you?
When I listen to my music, I'm always surprised, and I have to ask myself, did I write that? And in a positive way sometimes, did I write that in a less positive way? But we think of a piece of music being written and finished, and then it exists. But I imagine that even some of the greatest composers would love to have gone back and made some changes. I mean, Gustav Mahler famously was constantly changing his music. It was never finished for him. Even when he died, he hadn't finished his last symphony, but his earlier works, he was always making small changes and amendations. It's hard to imagine Mozart, who didn't live long enough, sadly, or Beethoven, same thing, going back and listening to a masterpiece and saying, you know, I really should change that note, or I should have added a second flute there, or something like that. But my guess is almost all composers, when they listen to their music, I'm sure they have some doubts or some thoughts about, I could have done that better, I should have done this better. But then you have to say it is what it is, and it has a life of its own, and you're done with it at that point. It no longer has very much to do with me. It has to do with how the musicians are interpreting it. That, again, for me, is a very exciting thing, very happy thing.
But also, it would be hard to know from you looking back, did you have them all in your mind, or did they creep in on their own on gentle feet to remind you?
That's interesting that you say that, because a wonderful Finnish composer, Kalevi Aho, and someone asked him about how he writes music. And he says, I start and I stop when I'm finished. But there's usually, in my mind, a plan of some kind. It's not like there'll be an 8-bar introduction followed by a 16-bar exposition followed by a 20-bar development or anything like that. But there's an idea of where it's going to go when I start. And I must say, it doesn't always end up there, but it usually does. It's kind of there, ready to go. And as I said, this when Philip called me, it came out very quickly, and I finished it. I mean, I want to say I can't remember how long, but it wasn't a long compositional process. And would I change things now? Not yet. I'm curious what it will sound like in May in Little Rock, and then let's see. Let's see if it has a life after that. Mm-hmm. That's always the saddest thing for a composer is world premiere and last performance in the same breath.
Now, you yourself play an instrument. Are you putting yourself into it?
No, I'm a clarinet player, and I received a commission to write a piece for a festival in 2020 for their 50th anniversary, and I play in the orchestra. So I'm going to be playing in the creation of a piece I wrote for orchestra, which will be a first for me. I guess I better write myself an easy part. I would hate to embarrass myself. But as I said, generally, if I write a concerted work, I have somebody's sound in mind. And even if I write a work for orchestra, I'm often thinking of that orchestra, its own aesthetic, its own unique personality, as well as the person that might be conducting it. So there's nothing of my woodwind playing in this concerto. People tell me that I write well for strings, and I've never played a string instrument, but the strings are close to my heart. I've never written anything for myself. That's not the way I write music, but I'm very honored that I'm still able to play. I play with Festival Mosaic this coming July in San Luis Obispo, California, with Scott Yu, and I play on a regular basis with the Festival Orchestra in Korea that tours Asia, and I'm getting up to or past what some people will call retirement age, but as long as they keep asking me to come back, I'm afraid I'll keep playing.
But on the other hand, you are learning yourself. And I just, as you were talking, I was thinking, which instruments is he working on at this particular moment? And if they are listening, anybody who knows these instrumentalists so well, and beginning to know you pretty well as well, I would say, that you are creating the whole thing because you are known and they trust you and the birds trust you, else they wouldn't come and sing in your branches the way that they seem to. And if they do, how do you thank them?
Well, that's a very interesting question, actually. Well, first of all, thanking musicians is a bit easier than thanking birds. But I think when you connect with nature, with animals, they're certainly aware of your presence. They often don't like you being there, I think. But I think just being there, admiring, listening is our way of thanking them. And then in a more, I suppose, practical way, and no one would ever accuse me of being very practical, we thank nature by looking after it, by taking care of it, by not abusing it, by always making space for it in our lives, in our hearts, and also in our living environments, that we protect habitat. I mean, that takes this conversation into a completely different and non-musical direction, but it's something that, for me, is very important.
Yes. Now, when you start a piece and you have in your mind, in your ear, what you would like to bring out of it, do you test it first? Just by thinking about it, do you mostly put the music down on paper when you're at home? Or are you doing something that you suddenly have to break off because the music is more important?
That's an interesting question. I mean, there are composers who have the problem of staring at the blank piece of paper, waiting for the spark from heaven to strike. I have the opposite problem. I write maybe a little too quickly, and maybe if I took more time to linger and think and ponder, I would write, let's say, better music. But I tend to write in a flurry of excitement, enthusiasm, and activity. And because writing music is not my day job is producing recordings. Sometimes when I'm in the middle of editing a recording or even in a recording session, I need to make a mental note that here's a musical idea that I really like that I want to put down. And sometimes I write just, I have 5 minutes here, 5 minutes there to write, or in the middle of things. It's rare for me to have a long period when I can focus on writing music. It's something that I very much would like to have more of, maybe someday. But it's still very much a part-time activity for me.
Well, well spent. I was also going to ask you, do you play to young people to show them or to lead them?
I recently was the composer in residence at a festival in Havana, Cuba, a wonderful musical city, and some of the most musical people I've ever met. And they asked me if I would talk to a composer's class from the university. And we had actually a very long and I thought very productive session. I learned a lot from them, and maybe they learned something from me. But what we talked about mainly was how we express ourselves. And when we express ourselves, we need someone else to understand it in order to perform that expression. That composition in some ways is, I hope, honest. And in that sense, the truest creative expression of who we are. So on the one hand, you're exposing yourself in a very merciless way, but you also have to have people who understand it. In a funny way, it's almost like the bond of friendship. When I give a piece of music to someone to play, it's a handshake is not the right way to put it, but there's a bond there where they need to understand you, your aesthetic, in order to interpret and express what you put into the music. And that's what I talked about with these young composers. And some of the young composers said, well, they're just writing it for themselves. But I'm not sure I believe that. Of course we write the music for ourselves. And I was once, I felt very embarrassed that I like my music. I'm not ashamed to say it. And I realized that I write the music that I want to hear. And no one else can really do that besides me. But yeah, I mean, sharing with young people, to go back to what, to your question, is a great joy. But the other thing that's more important in a selfish way is that they inspire me. These student composers in Cuba all had a lot to say about music, about writing music, about what it means in their lives. And we sat for several hours and just talked about it. It wasn't a class per se, though they did ask some very practical questions. But it's also about this idea of showing who you are creatively and how painful it can be sometimes, too. This is not really a discussion about Cuba, but I'll tell you one story, and of course you can cut it out if it's not germane or wasting time, but about sometime after midnight, I and two of the other musicians in the festival were walking back to the place we were staying. We'd had a few drinks, and as we walked we saw in an art gallery, which was strangely enough still open after midnight, a large portrait of John Cage, the American avant-garde composer. And we were staring at the picture, and the door opened, and the owner of the art gallery came out and said to us in English, "If you can tell me who that is, I'll give it to you." And I had to say, I can not only tell you who it is, but I knew him and worked with him. The man invited us in. He got out some coffee and tea. He put the close sign on the door, and we sat down and we talked about John Cage and Jasper Johns and Robert Rauschenberg and that whole group of artists till about 3 or 4 in the morning. And as we left, he gave each of us a very small painting from his gallery for free as a souvenir. And I thought, unbelievable, in Havana, Cuba, in the middle of the night, a portrait of John Cage in a window, and then a long discussion about the avant-garde arts, their importance, and their aesthetic. Again, for me, that was one of those amazingly unique experiences of being in Havana. It's the second time I went there as composer in residence for Habana Clásica, the first international classical music festival, and a very young string quartet, the Cuarteto de Cuerdas de Habana, played the premiere of my third string quartet, and I must say it was particularly beautiful. Very, very fine performance by these incredible young musicians who don't have good instruments. Also, the conservatories don't have pianos. They have electric Yamahas because of the embargo makes it difficult to get instruments into Cuba. There's concert halls with good pianos, but the schools don't have them, so the kids learn on electric pianos, which is a pity. I hope it all changes and that Cuba can come back, let's say, into the world and be able to have things like pianos in the music schools.
And yeah. Do you write a lot in the Netherlands?
I live here, so yes, this is where I write most of my music, though a lot of it's written on airplanes and trains. I do a lot of my recording work is done in England, France, Germany, and South Korea. So I'm there a lot as well. I'm not in the States as much as I'd like to be. I do have another premiere in Colorado Springs in June, a chamber symphony, which I'm excited about. Mm-hmm. But location is not... I mean, basically anywhere I am, I can write music. Now, the Netherlands has, I mean, no place is perfect. I think we're a bit scenically challenged here, but people are generally kind and tolerant. And there's a great deal of love and support for the arts, which I certainly appreciate. And as I say, my wife gets first-class medical care for the cancer here in the Netherlands, and it's affordable. So I have, I think we're very lucky that we ended up here.
And I can't believe that I've allowed you to talk so long to me, but I hope to see you soon.
All right. Hopefully I'll see you when I come to Little Rock at the end of or beginning of May.
Right. It's on my book.
Thanks, Anne.
Thank
you. Hope that
you.
Was okay. Hope it wasn't a disaster.
That was a preview of the Concerto for Oboe section, a world premiere by Michael Fine, commissioned by Philip Mann. It will air May 4th and 5th on Robinson Auditorium, Little Rock. And that concludes the program for this week. Please join us next weekend at the same time. I'm Ann Nicholson. Thank you for listening.
The Art Scene is a presentation of UA Little Rock Public Radio.